Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The Athletic.
This is the best club in the world. Don't care what other people think.
The Liverpool machine under Jurgen Klopp has been absolutely astonishing to watch, hasn't it? And it's all underpinned by those incredible levels of fitness and conditioning that the players have to achieve. So for this pod, we're going to look at what goes into helping them last the distance. Also, why UEFA have been accused of pre-planning the statement blaming late fans for the Paris chaos. If you're not already a subscriber to The Athletic, you can read all of the articles on Liverpool and everything on the site if you head to theathletic.com/Liverpool pod. And right now, the price is just £1 a month for 6 months. That's a special price, £1 a month for 6 months at theathletic.com/Liverpool pod. I'm Steve Hothersall. Simon Hughes joins me on the Red Agenda to take a closer look at a special report on Liverpool's medical department. You might have seen it on the site. It's fascinating stuff. And as I mentioned in the top of the pod, Liverpool's success under Klopp can be put down to a few things, but one of the most important elements is fitness, of course, the durability, the ability to keep putting it out there on the pitch at a high level, game after game. That's almost his trademark, Si.
Yeah, it is. When he became Liverpool's manager, obviously he arrived with a reputation of drilling his teams, both tactically and physically. It'd be the key to his success at Dortmund. And it's been the basis of pretty much everything that's happened at Liverpool over the last 7 years. The purpose of the piece really is just to examine, I guess, the consequences of that process and to see where it places Liverpool now, really. Because it hasn't been a great deal of change to the Liverpool team over the last 5 years. Obviously, additions here and there, but by and large, the same players since 2017-18, certainly since 2018. And as we've seen, it's been a sort of a tough start to the season where the team struggled at times to meet the I don't want to say the standards, but the potentially the expectations of the past when it comes to running, you know, being able to press teams, being able to harass teams. That's been what Liverpool have been synonymous with. And that obviously hasn't been happening. So the reason why I decided to investigate sort of the culture at the club, the culture behind fitness and treatment and recovery, I thought it was an important time to do that, really, and see both the positives and sort of the, well, you could say negatives, but the consequences of doing that over a long period of time.
And it's really interesting you've done it now, because obviously there is that conversation about the seven-season syndrome. There's always going to be comparisons to how Klopp fared at Dortmund and Mainz, because he adopted a similar approach, and that, you know, some people have that mindset, oh, he gets to seven seasons and things don't work properly after that. But was that almost a little bit of a thought underneath all this?
It was, yeah. I mean, there's obviously been a lot of talk about that, hasn't there? I mean, seven seasons is a long time, isn't it, to be playing largely. I mean, he's had a slightly different experience to Liverpool than he had at Dortmund, whereby at Dortmund, his best players, every 12, 18 months, 2 years, will get taken away by either Bayern Munich or maybe another big European club. At Liverpool, since the departure of Philip Coutinho until Sadio Mane, that hasn't really happened at all. Let's not forget Sadio Mane wanted to leave Liverpool. It was his decision. And that's why Liverpool granted his wish after a long period of service. So at Liverpool, he's managed to keep the team largely the same. So I would argue probably that there's more of a chance of this happening at Liverpool, you know, in terms of people have spoken about burnout happening, because, you know, year on year the players have been being asked to do similar things in terms of the demands, you know, whether it's pre-season or during the season in preparation for every game. So I spent a lot of time on the piece. It took a month or so to put together, really. I think the trigger point wasn't really wasn't really what you just suggested. It was the departure of Jim Moxon as the first team doctor. I thought the timing of it was very unusual, you know, just before the season started. There's been a big turnover over of staff at Liverpool. I'd heard one or two things about, like, sort of, you know, that not just the drain on the players but the staff as well. Yeah, you know, how tough it is to deliver what, you know, Klopp and the players expect, you know. So that was the starting point. So I've been on the story for a good month, spoken to lots and lots of people. I know there's maybe a perception of journalism now that you speak to one person, they give you the whole story of what's happened, and that's just not true. You obviously need to get it, everything that goes into the story, multiply sourced. That's an expectation, you know, at the Athletic, that we can't just put any old bit of information that we have into a story. We need to make sure that it's double, if not treble source. So that is the case with this piece. And, you know, the expectation on Liverpool year on year, certainly up until 2020, was during pre-season, players would be expected to run as much as 70 kilometres a week, you know, in pre-season. That's huge amount of running. And by and large, that served the team well, because during the course of a season, that expectation drops to, like, between 40 and 55 kilometres, depending on how many games a week you play. If you're playing a two-game week with all the training, it can be as much as 55 kilometres. So, again, that reinforces why pre-season is important. There's an internal debate at Liverpool about whether, you know, that distance is more of a psychological advantage over a physiological advantage. You know, the players feel, once they've got through pre-season, you know, it's a bit, you know, old school, really, like, you know, sort of going back to the boot room days, training so hard that the matches actually become quite relatively easy by comparison, you know, in terms of the tests on the body. So there's all that, you know, that examining the impact of that year on year on year, and where it, I suppose, it leaves Liverpool now. You know, that there's a sort of a big story through the piece about sort of the internal battles that have gone on at the club in that time as well, which I certainly wasn't fully aware of at the beginning of the process of speaking to people. I'd heard bits and bobs, but it's only when you sort of speak to one person, another person, you realise that, you know, there's a picture here which you can work with. So it was an interesting one to put together.
Do you know what? It's an absolutely fascinating deep dive, and it's an education, really, into what goes behind getting the players to a certain level. I encourage anyone to read it. I've sort of structured this pod around the order of the piece, if you like, because it makes a lot of sense. So at the very start of it, you start off by looking at the players who played the most minutes for Liverpool throughout that Klopp reign. And there's no surprise, really. Your Andy Robertsons, your Mo Salahs, your Trents, they're up there topping the charts, aren't they? Many of these players not having the luxury of the breaks that, you know, would help them reset, recover.
Well, obviously, Andy Robertson got injured in the Napoli game in the closing stages of that game with a knee injury. So a lot of the problems that Liverpool have had this season, I think they had 10 injuries by the end of August, and most of them were soft tissue muscle injuries. Now, I suppose you could have a debate around why Andy Robertson injured his knee. I mean, if he was in peak physical condition, would he have been able to move quicker in that situation, which would have got him away from the impact of the injury that he sustained? Or there has been a lack of clarification over exactly what the knee injury is. Is it wear and tear? So there is that sort of caveat. But Andy Robertson has done more mileage than any Liverpool player on a football pitch, I think it's since 2018. There was a bit of research into FIFPro, which is the union of footballers across Europe. They did a big study on players over a long period of time. I think it was something like 280 players. And Andy Robertson was high on the list of players that have played a lot of games in what they call the critical zone, where they should really probably be getting a bit more rest. So I think as much as more than 60% of his games have been played in that. And then I think that there's 20% of his games, there's only been a three-day gap in between one game and the other, which obviously is going to have a big impact on the player. I mean, people have been giving him a lot of quite fair amounts of criticism for his performances this season. He's been substituted a fair bit for Tsimikas, and Tsimikas has started one or two games instead of him. I think this all explains a bit of that, really, why I suspect that the club realised that, you know, that he does need some more rest. Unfortunately, Trent Alexander-Arnold wasn't examined by FIFPro, but given that he is not far behind Robertson in terms of the number of minutes he spent on a football pitch, you can probably draw similar conclusions about where his physical state is, I would say. Although he's played less international football, so there is that as well. So Yeah, I mean, these are two players, like Andy Robertson in mid to late 20s, Trent in his early 20s, still played huge amounts of football over quite a long period of time. It's easy to forget. It's like 5 years, 4 or 5 years, a long time in football when you're just at it all the time with very little rest, particularly when the demands are so high at Liverpool. So there is going to be a consequence for all of this, and maybe we're seeing a little bit of that now. I think Liverpool, it's since been put to me that Liverpool are trying to adopt their tactical style, you know, in terms of the expectations on running has dropped a little bit over the last couple of years. They're trying to be more possession-based. But the problem with that is that, you know, I think the data shows that this season compared to last season, you know, that the running data has dropped again. So I don't necessarily think that's by design, to be honest. You know, it's potentially quite alarming. So yeah, that was like sort of the intro of the piece, really, trying to bring it up to date of where some of the players are at, you know, trying to explain the exposure that they've had to match minutes and minutes on the grass.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Of course, side behind Jurgen Klopp and his first team coaching staff, there's a whole host of people involved in the sports science department, whether that be physios, performance gurus. One guy who was pretty fundamental to Liverpool's success in recent years, he's not there now, he's left the football club, but he was there when they won the Premier League, there when they won the Champions League, was Philip Jakobsen. Just tell us about his involvement and how pivotal he was to the success of this side.
Okay, there's quite a lot to unpack here, really. So, yeah, he joined as the head of performance in 2018. Now, it was an interesting appointment because the idea was to sort of try and bring a lot of the staff in line, really, with, you know, and have a one philosophy between all the staff and improve the communication between the different departments, whether it's the physios, the sports scientists and the fitness team, because the first few years at Liverpool, certainly, there were quite a few problems. You know, Jurgen Klopp brings with him his own inner circle of staff, if you like. So that would be Peter Kravets in the early years, Buvac, who obviously since left in 2018. Pep Linders sort of rose up through the ranks. He didn't bring Pep Linders with him. He inherited him, but really liked him. And he became part of that sort of inner circle, if you like. People who he sort of trusts and speaks to, you know, and confides in. You know, they get the sort of the worst of his moods and sort of the best of his moods as well when that comes. The sort of the secondary staff, if you like. So that's, as I said, the outer circle of physios, sports scientists, fitness people. They're by and large appointed by the sporting director. So that would have been Michael Edwards at the time. Now, there was a bit of a, you know, cultural clashes between ideas about how to operate according to what the expectations were by Jurgen Klopp. And it was identified by Michael Edwards that somebody needed to sort of oversee this process and bring people more in line with one another. So that's where Philip Jakobsen comes in. He previously worked with Michael Edwards at Portsmouth going back, you know, a long time, so that they knew each other. He'd worked in a clinic in Qatar for a long period of time, almost a decade before he arrived at Liverpool. So that was the thought process behind his appointments. Unfortunately, it's been explained to me that, you know, in those early days, it was quite clear that he was going to have a tough time convincing people that his way was sort of the right way. He was very protocol driven, wanted to know the science behind all the decisions that were like sort of being made. A key sort of lieutenant of Jurgen Klopp is Andreas Kornmeyer, who people have seen on the touchline, you know, looks like Jurgen Klopp. He's got the same glasses, similar hair. He was hired from Bayern Munich in the summer of 2016 with the remit, really, of drilling the players, getting them fit, supremely fit. So it was a big responsibility on Andreas Kornmeyer. You know, he replaced Ryland Morgans, who'd been Brendan Rodgers' man in that field, and he was very much a Klopp appointment, Andreas Kornmeyer, and deserves a huge amount of credit, I would say, for getting the players to a level that I think a lot of people probably didn't think was possible over a long period of time. That being said, I think there was a few personality clashes with people behind the scenes, he was very much sort of, he was not quite as protocol driven, if you like. He would sometimes decide decisions on a what players would work on the day, rather than necessarily sort of go through a long process of discussion, which happens sometimes. So this happens at every football club, of course. You know, the idea that even at the most successful football clubs that everybody gets on famously is just not true. It shouldn't necessarily be so much of a surprise, this, I would say, if you're reading it. But then equally, it is the reality of it. I think that does need to be reflected. You know, that with, you know, the pursuit of success, there's a lot of collateral that happens as well.
But something worked perfectly, didn't it, to get them to Champions League success, league success in that period. So obviously the pieces of the machine all blended properly at that point.
Well, no, not really. I wouldn't say that's true. I'd say that certainly Cornmayer was able to get distance into the players' legs, which helped. But it was put to me that between 2018 and 2020, there was a lot of sort of internal bickering, really, that was going on about the best way forward. And Jakobsen wasn't really able to get across what he felt needed to happen to be able to make better decisions about the players' physical state, I would say. So this contributes to Jakobsen leaving in 2020, just after Liverpool win the league title. He left the club a year ahead of his contract ending. You know, I think Liverpool at the time put a statement out saying that he was returning to Germany. Transpired that it was on gardening leave. He has since done work for other parts of Fenway Sports Group. So he's worked for, I think, the Boston Red Sox. So he's clearly highly valued by Michael Edwards and other people at FSG. But unfortunately, it just didn't quite work out when he was there. So Liverpool carried on pushing on. You know, he was getting a better team with more experience throughout this period. It's not an exact science, football. Not everything. Sometimes things happen in spite of relationships, I would say. You know, you could argue, I mean, we were discussing before the podcast, you know, when Rafa Benitez won the Champions League, it certainly wasn't because Liverpool were the best team in Europe or had the best system. Sometimes sparks happen which allows teams to flourish. It's not necessarily because it's the best in class in everything that it does. So Filip Jakobsen's obviously left in 2020. There's been a big turnover of staff in that period, which has led to Jim Moxon leaving. He was the club, sort of the club doctor, really, for a relatively short period of time, 18 months to 2 years. And now they're trying to find another club doctor. So clearly there are things that need to be resolved. Going to be interesting to see how that unravels, because Michael Edwards has since left. Julian Ward, his successor, might have his own ideas. Whether Jurgen Klopp will have more of a say, you know, on appointments below his inner circle, that will be interesting to see. Because after Filip Jakobsen left, Jurgen Klopp was able to get Andreas Schlumberger in as in a similar role, really very similar titled role. His sort of emergence in terms of seniority has been a bit slower, really. But that doesn't mean, that's not being critical. It just means that I think he's taken time to sort of survey what's going on. I believe that he has got a very good relationship with most staff now. He's been able to shape and make more appointments himself around what he thinks needs to happen at Liverpool. So yeah, that will be interesting to see over the next sort of 12, 18 months, how his relationship changes with people as he becomes more senior and takes more senior decisions. I think Liverpool made an appointment on his say-so over the summer. You know, I think that reflects really that he is becoming a bit more, has a bit more power at the club now.
There's so many layers to the medical staff here, aren't there? And the piece details them perfectly. So, you know, you have a look at that and you're reading about different people like Schlumberger and Cornmayer, who you might not know much about, but all of a sudden it makes a lot more sense. The idea of fitness, you could look at it in a couple of ways. One, yeah, you've got to get them as fit as possible, but you've also got to keep them fit, injury-free, haven't you? And there's a big point made in the piece that while Man City and Liverpool have done that, the majority of Man City title-winning seasons have been where they've managed to keep their players fit. It's coincided with that.
Yeah, that's sort of the conclusion of the piece, really. There's a prevailing feeling in football of the importance of injuries and keeping players fit. So there was a study done by an Israeli group of analysts, I think it was the 2017-18 season, where they established there was a correlation between points and injuries that you have and days missing, as well as positions. And if that is 100% accurate, it's fair enough to say that last season and each of the last three seasons, when Liverpool have won the league, City have won the league twice, the injuries have massively influenced really the destination of the title. I think City last season had something like 300 and north of 300 days less missed through injury in terms of their players, which means that by the calculations of this study, that could have been worth 2 points to them. And if they don't have those 2 points, Liverpool win the league. So it's quite frustrating, I suppose, from a Liverpool perspective, if you hear it like that. And then obviously you see the season before where Liverpool's season's absolutely decimated by injury. Okay, one of the injuries to Virgil van Dijk, you can't legislate for. You know, it's an impact injury. If you've done your knee in, you're going to be out for a long period of time. But the issue is that I think where Liverpool probably can learn lessons from that is that when things tend to go well at Liverpool when there are fewer injuries and the selection is more consistent and there's not as much chopping and changing it. You could say that about any team, you know, the sort of the machine of Liverpool rolls on in these periods. But the issue that Liverpool have is that when two or three players are missing, the two or three players that have to step up have to quickly get used to the expectations in terms of running. So whether that's, you know, sort of a jump from maybe 28 kilometres a week to 40 or to 55, that's a big jump. So getting the distance into those players' legs, there's a danger around that, you know, within Kieran Moranges, because the players aren't as used to running that level of distance. No matter how many training matches or training sessions you have, there's no substitute for matches, really. Competitive matches, you know, people call them bounce games in you know, at the training facility in Kirby. Obviously, they have a purpose, but you can't really recreate the sort of the match level intensity where points are being played for. So this is the challenge for Liverpool, you know, to try and bridge that gap, really. I mean, one of the things that was put to me was that obviously at Liverpool, there's a very much a player fair sort of culture, whereby, again, this probably does happen at other clubs, but, you know, that Jurgen Klopp, you never hear a player complain about Jurgen Klopp. I mean, it just doesn't happen. When they had the really terrible run 2 seasons ago and they lost 6 games on the bounce, there was no grumblings from players, agents, nothing like that. They sort of sympathise with Klopp, really, which you don't often get in football. He has absolute trust of players. And that's because that they know, really, that he's on their side 100%. But that has a consequence, I would say, for staff, you know, in terms of, particularly when the attitude towards training is so intense. You know, the players are so committed to training. But it's been put to me, you know, that if you try and tell a player, well, you should probably not train today. Quite difficult position to be in, because the player is the player going to listen to the member of staff, or is he going to go with his instincts and train? So there's that whole sort of culture that is has both contributed towards the success of Liverpool, but it makes it harder to sort of, I would say, for staff to sort of monitor the injuries and preserve the player's physical state at times. The thing is, Steve, at every football club, no system is absolutely perfect. With some stuff that you gain, you lose other bits, don't you? This isn't a piece that says, well, you know, this is, you know, sort of bad that what Liverpool have been doing. It's just reflecting that there are consequences for the choices that they make. I suspect, you know, that there probably will need to be a turnover of players at some point, you know, in the near future. I think that process has already begun. I think we can see that. And I think that's also affecting the results at the moment. Obviously, changing players, slight change in style, you know, new players still getting used to the team. It's obviously having an impact on the team, really, and the fluidity of the way they play.
It's an intriguing insight into what goes into sort of tuning the players. Special report, balancing players, pressure and performance in Liverpool's medical department. Size written, it's on the Athletic site right now, so you can read that in much more detail.
Hello, I'm Lindsay Hooper, host of the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. After the euphoria of the Euros in the summer, the WSL is back with some massive shocks already. This weekend, there's some mouthwatering ties with a record crowd expected for the North London Derby at the Emirates. And it's Derby Day on Merseyside too. Plus, there's a titanic tussle in South London as Chelsea and Manchester City go head-to-head, both looking for their first points of the season. For all the insight and opinion you need, join me and our stat panel of experts this week and every week on the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. Listen for free and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Going to move on from there to a story which broke yesterday. I think David Conn from The Guardian led on this one. UEFA pre-prepared the Champions League final statement blaming late fans. So we're all aware of it. We're all aware of what happened in Paris and the problems that went around the match. But the idea of the statement being pre-prepared in the days ahead of the game is shocking, really, Si.
Yeah, I only wish that they pre-prepared all the match arrangements with the same, well, I was going to say stealth, but clearly not. I've been thinking a lot about this, Steve, over the last 24 hours, and accompanying that piece in The Guardian, there was a very good sort of video story, picture story of how everything unraveled on the day. And I would implore anyone who might feel a bit uncertain about exactly what happened to read it. And look at the images that story uses, because again, it just reminded me that everything really comes down to a lack of organisation. I was there in the stands, not in a press seat on the night, and I could tell on approach to the ground exactly what the problem was. It was two very simple aspects that if these issues were dealt with effectively, not just by UEFA but by the local planning committee and the match organisers, that we wouldn't be having this conversation now. The French failure, again, to react to a train strike. You know, workers obviously entitled to strike. There was no concession made for that, which meant that one train station, a central hub on approach to the ground, wasn't being used. So everyone was piling through the same train station. There was no contingency made for that eventuality, which meant that when we approached the ground, I think I can't remember if it was a T-junction or a crossroads, but there was a point where there was a very basic old sign which said Stad left. Everybody was taking that route. Now, if there'd been stewards or any signage sending people back towards the other route, towards the other train station that was closed, we would not be having this conversation now. But there was none of that. There was no signs, nothing. There was no guidance, absolutely nothing, which meant that everybody ended up at exactly the same point, at exactly the same time, which led to a crushing situation, which led to the collapse of the security operation. It's just so simple. It probably doesn't need as much investigation. I don't understand why UEFA had taken so long with this investigation. It's already appeared before the French Senate and they've drawn their conclusions. Obviously, there's been huge reporting over it, which reflected sort of what has happened. I think that the reporting on it has generally been excellent. A lot of reporters were caught up in it. I'm a bit concerned, I must say, that UEFA are planning to release their findings in November.
Now, the end of November.
The end of November, when there's a World Cup on. Where's the attention of the world going to be at this time? It's a very easy way to bury something that either is damning on UEFA or potentially, again, scapegoats the fans. I mean, I cannot use words strongly enough about how people behaved on that day. When you talk about behaviour, it has a negative connotation. Had it not been for fans, there would have been a disaster at that football ground. I have absolutely no doubt about that. And it was the collective memory of Liverpool fans that stopped that happening. So unless this UEFA report admits that their failings, it's not good enough, as far as I'm concerned, and a lot of other people are concerned, to say, well, we gave the Stade de France, we gave it to them, it's their problem. It was put to me like this yesterday, and I totally agree with it. If you have a bouncy castle and there's a problem with the bouncy castle and somebody gets badly hurt because the bouncy castle breaks at a garden fete or something, it's not just the manufacturers that get the blame, it's the organisers as well, and UEFA organised this event. So if they're awarding it to Stade de France, they must have confidence that event can take place. And I know that Seferin, the UEFA president, has been quoted as saying that they bent over backwards to try and get this event on. If they don't think it's possible to host a Champions League final at short notice because of a global event in Ukraine, because obviously there's been a war there and there's no games going to be played in Russia, then they should have either cancelled the final altogether because safety comes first, or they should have had a two-legged affair at Anfield and in the Bernabeu, two grounds which have hosted lots of Champions League games, you know, and is capable of doing so. It's just not good enough. So they, I think, for the first time ever, have to look inwards, because if they don't, I think a lot of people aren't going to feel safe at their matches anymore.
We should remind ourselves that UEFA has not admitted any failings at all itself, or retracted the statement about supporters either, Si. And as you say, as to this statement being released or report being released at the end of November, it just feels at the moment like a bit of a fudge, doesn't it? But that news breaking yesterday, and there is a terrific piece on the Guardian, UEFA pre-prepared Champions League final statement blaming late fans. Well done to David Conn, who's written on that, and a great video that goes with it as well. I think we'll leave it there for the Red Agenda. Once again, let me direct you to Si's special report, Balancing Players, Pressure and Performance. Really worth a read on what goes on in the medical situation behind the players' performance. And thank you very much indeed for listening. Catch up with you again next week. See you then.